Go.
Hello, everyone. This is David Seeloff with Associates for Scriptural Knowledge speaking for The Bite Show. And George Ann is a little under the weather, but she's there at the other end of the controls and running everything. So she's asked me just to talk and to continue on with our presentations of The Star of Bethlehem, the book written by Ernest L. Martin. And we're on Chapter 5. And Chapter 5 is specifically about the time of Jesus' birth. So I'm just going to move on and just talk. And but, you know, rest assured, George Ann is here. And, you know, she needs your prayers and your, you know, support to keep this show on the road, so to speak. So let's get into the time of Jesus' birth, Chapter 5 of The Star That Astonished the World, which is all about the Star of Bethlehem. Dr. Martin continues, "The suggestion was made in the last chapter, Chapter 4, that the Magi presented their gifts to Jesus on December 25th, in 2 BC. This was not, however, the time of his birth. When the Magi arrived, Joseph and Mary were no longer in a stable with Jesus. They were now residing in a house, according to Matthew 2, verse 11. Now, Jesus had been circumcised already, according to Luke chapter 2, verse 21, and had been dedicated at the temple some 40 days after his birth, according to Luke chapter 2, verses 22 to 24. At that time, when the Magi presented their gifts, Jesus was called a paideon, which in a sense is a toddler, and no longer was considered or listed as being a brephos, an infant. When the Magi arrived, Jesus was already walking and was able to speak a few words, as most normal children would be able to do when as several months old. Soon after the Magi left, King Herod killed the male children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years of age or younger. This is according to Matthew chapter 2, verse 16. Now, this does not mean that Jesus was exactly 2 years old at that time. The fact that all children 2 years and under were slain shows that Herod was taking every possible interpretation of the Magi into account for the time of Christ's birth. Since it was not clear in astrological interpretation by the Magi whether the appearance of a star or a planet signified the conception or the birth of a child, Herod decided to kill all the children born within a 2-year period in order to cover both possibilities. When all these evidences are considered together, it shows that Jesus was certainly a few months old when the Magi presented their gifts. There is biblical information which could go a long way in helping us understand the general time period for Jesus' birth. Luke gave more chronological data regarding the birth and ministry of Jesus than any other biblical writer. And in doing this, Luke began his story with John the Baptist. He gave some chronological indications as to the time of John's conception and birth. Though his statements are general in nature, they are plain enough to indicate the approximate time of John's birth, and consequently that of Jesus himself. These are all clues that can help lead us to various elements of the conclusion. This chronological information is found in Luke's first chapter. Now, note what Luke said. Quote, in Luke chapter 1, verse 5, quote, "There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zechariah of the course Abijah, and his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth." So she was also a Levitical descendant, Zechariah's wife. Now, this verse tells us something about the parents of John the Baptist. Zechariah was a priest whose duty it was, on certain occasions, to offer the national sacrifices in the temple at Jerusalem while he was accomplishing his assigned requirements. Luke said that an angel came to Zacharias and told him that his wife Elizabeth would bear a child. Zechariah could hardly believe what he was told because Elizabeth was beyond the age of childbearing. The angel understood his reason for disbelief, so Zechariah was struck dumb to prove the certainty of what was prophesied. When Zechariah came out of the inner temple, the people perceived that he had seen a vision, and they were amazed that he was unable to speak. They realized that something significant had been pointed out to Zechariah. Luke tells us that all this happened while Zechariah, quote, executed the priest's office before God in the order of his course, according to Luke 1, verse 8. He was performing his priestly duties, quote, according to the custom of the priest's office, end quote. Luke 1, verse 9. Excuse me. Zechariah's course was that of Abijah. The King James Version has Abijah in Luke 1, verse 5. Now, what was this course, and when did it serve? There were 24 priestly courses that administered the services in the temple. They are enumerated in 1 Chronicles chapter 24. Each course had a title associated with it. These were the names of the leaders who headed each course in the time of David, King David. Samuel and King David were the persons responsible for establishing the 24 courses of the priests. And this is according to 1 Chronicles 9, verse 22. Originally in the time of Moses, the priesthood was confined only to Aaron and his immediate sons. But by the time of Samuel and David, that family had grown to such proportions that they could not all officiate together at one time in the temple. That's why Samuel and David divided the priests into 24 separate groups, which were called orders or courses. The course in which Zechariah served was the eighth, that of Abijah, according to 1 Chronicles 24, verse 10. Josephus, the Jewish historian, was also a priest, and he mentioned that he was a member of the first course, called that of Jehoiarib. And this is in Josephus, his Life of Josephus, 1-3. Now, the original 24 priestly families established by David performed their services in the temple until the Babylonians destroyed the sanctuary in the 6th century B.C. When the Jews returned to Palestine, they rebuilt the temple, but they discovered that representatives of only four courses of the original 24 were still accounted for. And this is in Ezra chapter 2, verses 36 to 39. Something had to be done to restore the 24 courses to their ordained service in the temple as commanded by David. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Under the authority of Ezra, the remaining four were divided back into their former number. Thus, a new set of 24 courses commenced their administrations in the temple. And though these family courses were different from the ones established by David, it was decided that each course was to retain the name of the family which headed each course back in David's time, according to that time period, in other words. The reestablishment of these 24 courses was accepted as proper by the New Testament authorities because John the Baptist's father was reckoned to be of this new arrangement. The 24 elders mentioned in the book of Revelation also reflected this new arrangement, so that it was well accepted in New Testament times. And in other words, the change was authoritative. The 24 courses were also calendar indications. These 24 courses ordered by Samuel and David and later by Ezra the priest, with full authority to make those changes, to serve, were ordered to serve once a week in the temple services at two different times each year for a one-week period, for once a week. The first family of priests commenced their administrations at noon on the Sabbath, which was our Saturday, and they were relieved of duty the following Sabbath at noon. The Bible said that, quote, they were to come in on the Sabbath, end quote, and to serve until they, quote, were to go out on the Sabbath, end quote. This is from 2 Chronicles 23, verse 8, and 2 Kings 11, verse 5. The second course then began its service in the second week, and the third course in the third week, etc. Since each course administered for 1 week, it follows that there was a 24-week period for each of the courses to have its chance of serving. This occupied a span of about 6 months. When this was accomplished, the series started all over again. In a period of 48 weeks, each course would have served for 2 weeks, with each session being separated from the other by about 6 months. There are just over 52 weeks in each solar year, as we know, and the Jewish calendar, on the other hand, is a lunar solar calendar. In ordinary years, it only has about 51 weeks. At particular intervals, the Jewish authorities had to add an extra month of 30 days to keep it in season with the motions of the sun. In a 19-year period, 7 extra months were usually added. But, as said before, all normal years with the Jews had about 51 weeks. The priests served in their courses for 48 of those weeks. This means that there were 3 weeks in the year, which were not reckoned in this accounting. What happened with those 3 weeks? Well, David provided the answer back in his day. The courses served together at the three festival seasons. Since there were three major holy seasons on the Jewish calendar, the season of Passover, season of Pentecost, and the season of Tabernacles, and since at those times there were great crowds which were commanded, if you could do so, within reach, easy travel of Jerusalem, there were great crowds at Jerusalem. As an aside, as I've mentioned before, Jerusalem was a convention town, and that convention gathered three times a year, in the early spring, in the late spring, just before summer, and in the fall. So that Jerusalem expanded greatly, some say 5 times, some say 10 times its usual population during the feasts. Now, back to the text. David ordained that all 24 courses were to serve together for the week of Passover, the week when Pentecost occurred, and during the week of Tabernacles. And it says in 2 Chronicles 5, verse 11, quote, for all the priests that were present, specifically in this verse in Tabernacles, did not then wait by course, end quote. At Tabernacles and also at Passover and Pentecost, the priestly courses were suspended. In other words, they did not then wait by course, as it says in 2 Chronicles 5:11. In actual fact, all the courses of priests served together during those three holy seasons, because actually they had so much more to do, they had to perform so many more sacrifices, both individual sacrifices that people would have brought to the temple, as well as the required sacrifices that were demanded during those feast days that God had established during those feast periods. In actual fact, all the courses of priests served together during those three holy seasons. But in all other normal weeks, the various courses were doing their assigned work at the temple. In the case of Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, Luke said that he was officiating in his regular office, the eighth course period, or the eighth week, when the angel said his wife Elizabeth was to have a child. This is a chronological clue. And Luke meant it to be that way. He was showing his readers the general time of year that Zechariah was serving. We know that Zechariah was not serving at the festival period because the priests, as it says in the verse, quote, did not then wait by course, end quote. Also, it was either in the first half of the year when the course of Abijah served, or it was in the second half. Now let's look at this course of Abijah, because we can know the approximate times when it served in the temple. Now, we're going to deal now with the chronology of the 24 courses. It is perfectly reasonable that the priestly courses started their serving in the springtime month of Nisan, the first month of the Jewish ecclesiastical year. This was the customary time ordained in the Bible when priests began their administrations. And this is in Exodus chapter 40, verses 1 to 38, in the time of Moses. David arranged the 24 courses of the priests to coincide with the time when each of the 12 tribes of Israel had their representatives helping in the temple service. Each of the 12 tribes administered an entire month. They, quote, came in and went out month by month throughout all the months of the year, the first course of the first month, end quote. 1 Chronicles 27, verses 1 to 2. Now, the first month for temple services was the month called Nisan. The first month-long course of the 12 tribes began at the beginning of that springtime month. This must also have been the first month for the priests. The 24 priestly courses, however, lasted only for 1 week, from Sabbath to Sabbath. Their courses started with the Sabbath just before the beginning of Nisan, in order for the priests to be on duty to perform their regular ceremonials on Nisan 1. The same procedure was also followed for their second yearly tenure, commencing 6 months later at the month, the Jewish month called Tishri 1. There is even in the New Testament a reference to this second yearly tenure, which commenced 6 months after the first. In Luke chapter 6, verse 1, in some manuscripts, we read what appears to be a strange statement, at least strange to some scholars. It says that the Sabbath day on which Jesus excused his disciples for picking grain was the second first Sabbath. Many manuscripts, and in the writings of several early church fathers of Christendom, they state that this event was performed on the second first Sabbath. This must be a true reading of the original text, and its supposed oddity is what helps actually to explain its meaning. What in the world was the second first Sabbath? Well, the answer is easy to determine. The truth is, the phrase was a regular calendar indication that all Jews in the time of the temple understood. The answer is plain. Luke is using the phrase, second first Sabbath. Luke, in using the phrase, second first Sabbath, was simply following the regular order of the 24 courses of the priests, because this chronological indication was a reference to their second cycle, beginning with Tishri 1. And the disciples picked the grain on the first weekly Sabbath of that second yearly tenure. The first weekly Sabbath would have been called the second Sabbath. Of course, during the week of Tabernacles, all the 24 priests would have attended to the temple ceremonies together in a different arrangement of shifts. But the first weekly Sabbath after the Tabernacles, the routine would have continued, and that weekly Sabbath would have then been called the second Sabbath. In other words, the next Sabbath after that would have been the second, fourth Sabbath, etc., until the priests reached the second, 24th Sabbath. After that, the priests restarted the cycle once again with the first weekly Sabbath associated with the first day of Nisan of the next year. They would have called that first Sabbath the first Sabbath. The second would have been called the first second Sabbath, etc. However, when weekly Sabbaths occurred inside the festival weeks of Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, those intervening Sabbaths, which were not counted in the two cycles each year, were called between Sabbaths, or in other words, Sabbaths that were in between the cycles. And Luke even refers to one of these between Sabbaths that occurred during the week of Pentecost. Note in Acts chapter 13, verse 42, where the phrase, the next Sabbath, end quote, is found in the King James Version, which is really said in the Greek, the between Sabbath, in Acts 13, 42. This means that Luke in the New Testament was well aware, even though Luke is a Gentile, was well aware of the 24 priestly courses, and he knew the specifics concerning the weekly Sabbaths, in which the 24 priestly courses changed their weekly tenures two times a year, separated by a six-month period. These indications by Luke are calendar references, and they give us important clues to help us understand some New Testament chronological facts. Now, before we look at the chronological indications of the priestly courses to determine the time of the year John the Baptist was born, and consequently give us further clues to the nativity period for Jesus, let us find the proper year for Jesus' birth. Then we can know what year to apply the chronological clues within the priestly cycle of priestly courses for the month of John the Baptist's birth, and then also that of Jesus. The year for the birth of Jesus is not difficult to determine if we allow all of the biblical and historical information to be used in our appraisal. What was the precise year of Jesus' birth? Well, if the simple chronological statements of Luke are accepted, the nativity of Jesus must be placed in 3 or 2 BC. The historical evidences that I have presented, Dr. Martin says, in this book, support this conclusion. However, there is a problem that is not solved by Luke's narrative alone. He said that Jesus began his ministry in Roman Emperor Tiberius's 15th year, when Jesus was, quote, about 30 years of age, end quote. I will show in a moment what Luke meant by the phrase, about 30 years of age. But for now, let us note that Luke does not inform us whether Jesus was, quote, about 30, near the beginning, the middle, or near the end of the year Tiberius 15. Further, we are not told whether it was the Roman method of reckoning Tiberius 15th year, or that which the people of Judea and Syria were accustomed to, which antedated the reign of kings and emperors from Tishri 1 of the previous year. In other words, if you were born a few days before the new year, the entire year in which you were born was counted as your first year. Now, in spite of this, it will not be difficult to determine what Luke was using, that Luke was using the ordinary method of dating Tiberius' fifth year, as was common among the Easterners in the empire. And this can be seen in an excellent description of this regnal type reckoning is in Harold Honer's book, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ, pages 34 and 35. And you can get this bibliography information specifically in the introduction to this Dr. Martin's book, where we have the full bibliography of every book that we cite. Now, this is an important thing to know, to understand in identifying the Star of Bethlehem, as to when this 15th year of Tiberius Caesar was. This is because we must know the year in which Jesus was born to see if the celestial pageantry of 3 to 2 BC would fit the chronological indications in the New Testament. And indeed, it fits remarkably well. The method of reckoning the 15th year of Tiberius is an interesting one, but very understandable and consistent. It simply means that in the eastern part of the empire, the entire year in which Tiberius became the emperor of Rome, which was August 19th, 14 CE, is awarded to Tiberius as his first year. Even though it was only a portion of the year, as you and I would reckon it, the entire year was considered to be his first year. That simplifies chronological reckoning in those days. It means that the New Year's Day, for the beginning of that year, begins the first year of Tiberius. This would have been on Tishri 1, the first day of Tishri, in the year in which Tiberius came to rulership. Thus, the entire year was, the entire first year of Tiberius was from Tishri 1 in 13 AD to Tishri 1 in 14 AD. Consequently, Tiberius' 15th year would have been from Tishri 1 in 27 AD to 28 AD, Tishri 1. And we have more information about this in a later chapter. Now, if Jesus was about 30 years old at the commencement of Tiberius' 15th year, as reckoned by people in the East, then working backwards about 30 years, his birth was in 3 BC. Jesus' birth was in 3 BC. Recall that Luke tells us that Jesus was born at the time of a Roman census or enrollment, as we covered in earlier chapters. If we can determine the period of that registration, this will help to pinpoint the year of the Nativity. This is where the new historical information offered in this book becomes essential. We now know that an empire-wide citizen registration for the award of the Pater Patriae upon Augustus took place in early 2 BC. This was the census that Luke meant, and we will give a full account of this registration or census in a further chapter of this book titled The Census of Quirinius, chapter 12. But let me, says Dr. Martin, briefly rehearse some of the evidence that shows when the census mentioned in the New Testament took place. This registration, the census of Quirinius, took place in 3 BC. Now, Lewin, in his book, Fasti Sacri, about this event, Lewin points out that Augustus was already being called the Pater Patriae, Father of the Nation, on one or two inscriptions by the year 3 BC. In late 3 BC, he was offered the title by a deputation of people who met him at Antium, the city of Antium. And though he refused this title until the Senate bestowed it upon him on February 5th, 2 BC, also called the Day of Concord in Roman reckoning. This is good evidence that all the Roman people must have started to give him this most prestigious title sometime in 3 BC. And interestingly, our historical reconstruction, as shown in this book, shows that an oath of obedience to Augustus was demanded of all people in Judea in 3 BC, according to Josephus Antiquities, chapter 17, sections 41 to 45. Now, this oath would have been required of Joseph and Mary. But even more than that, a Pamphlagonian inscription shows that an oath of obedience was required of all Roman citizens and non-citizens in exactly the same year, in 3 BC. Moses of Kyrene, the early Armenian historian, quoted sources which relates which related that the census mentioned by Luke was also administered by Roman agents in Armenia, a neighboring country to Pamphlagonia, in 3 BC. And the words of Moses of Kyrene about the event was very similar to that of the Pamphlagonian inscription. Orisius in the 5th century also said that in 3 BC, an oath or a census was commanded of all nations at the time of Augustus, was honored as the first of all men, an appropriate description of the title Pater Patriae. Remarkably, Orisius said that the empire, this empire-wide census, was the census mentioned by Luke in his gospel. This information strongly suggests that the census which brought Moses and or Joseph and Mary to Bethlehem was conducted in the summer or early autumn of 3 BC. A census by the Romans would hardly have been ordered in the early spring or late autumn, and certainly not in winter when the rainy season was in evidence. You wouldn't do it in the early spring because that's when planting took place, and you wouldn't do it in the late autumn because that's when the harvest would take place. So you had to do it when the farmers weren't doing either or. And this is talked about in William F. Ramsey's book, Born at Bethlehem. Ramsey expressed confidence that the normal time for a Roman census was sometime from August to October, depending on the local conditions of the crops. Thus, the latter part of 3 BC makes it perfectly good sense. So let's return then to consider the chronology of the priestly courses regarding the birth of John the Baptist. The priestly courses will help us arrive at the general period for the birth of John and also of Jesus, because it says in Luke chapter 1, verse 36, that John was born about 6 months before Jesus. Not specifically 6 months, but about 6 months. This would indicate that the conception of John, as well as that of Jesus, was probably, most likely, occurring in 4 BC. Now, Luke mentioned that Zechariah was serving at his regular time of administration during the week when the 8th course of Abijah served. This course had duty 2 times each year, once in the late spring and again in the late autumn. Look at the spring session. We find out that the first day of Nisan occurred in 4 BC. We must first find out when the first day of Nisan occurred in 4 BC. Now, this is not a simple task in some years. This is because the calendar of the Jews in the first century was dependent on the state of the crops around Jerusalem in order that certain ritualistic duties could then be performed regarding the first fruits. And this was necessary for the priests to observe the ripeness of the barley before they could or would allow any ecclesiastical year to begin. If 12 lunar months had passed from the beginning of the previous year, it was the normal custom to start the next year with the 13th month, which of course would have been reckoned as Nisan, the first month of the new year. But if the barley was not yet ripe enough, the priests often postponed the start of the year for 1 month. Now, for you and me, Georgiana, and the audience, who probably are not up on matters of the calendar, this sounds difficult and confusing, but there is a system to it, and the system is not that difficult, especially if you grew up in an agricultural society and this was a part of your everyday life. So this is not as tough as it sounds, okay? Thankfully, in 4 BC, this agricultural requirement was not a problem. The month of Nisan began on March 29, and that is always late enough in the year to allow no quibbling over the state of the crops. And the barley was always early near Jericho, but the crops usually were judged in the region of Jerusalem. This date was also Nisan 1, on the Babylonian calendar, which had some correspondence to the Jewish calendar. However, quote, according to Parker and Dubenstein in Babylonian Chronology, page 25, quote, the new moon was visible at Jerusalem 37 minutes before it was visible at Babylon. And therefore, upon occasion, the new month could begin a day earlier in Jerusalem, end quote. In the year 4 BC, this factor was a definite possibility. But in this reckoning, Dr. Martin will follow the date given by Parker and Dubenstein, the noted authorities regarding the calendars of the Babylonians and the Jews in this period. Yet even if Nisan 1 were a day earlier in Jerusalem, it is of no consequence to our present question. Recall also that when we say Nisan 1 was March 29, it must be understood that the day actually commenced the previous evening at sundown on March 28, because all Jewish days begin at sundown. Now, to illustrate how this information can help us arrive at the approximate time of John the Baptist's birth, understand that the first of Nisan in 4 BC was March 29. The priestly courses began their administrations on the Sabbath near the first of Nisan. This is according to Van Gotover's biblical calendars. And while there was a belief among some Dead Sea sects that the duties of the first course started on Nisan 12, we have to remember that the people of Qumran were out of the mainstream of Jewish thought. Not only that, but the Jewish sects were not in charge of were not in charge of the temple, and their opinions should not lead in any way in our inquiries regarding the course of Abijah. There would only be a two-week discrepancy in any case, and even that is not enough to seriously upset the chronological indications associated with the course of Abijah, which we're dealing with. The main Jewish custom, however, had the first priestly course commencing its duty on the Sabbath before Nisan 1. The Sabbath just prior to March 29 was March 24. This indicates that the week of service for the course of Jehoiarib, the first course, was from Sabbath noon, March 24, to Sabbath noon, March 21. The second course began March 31 and served to April 7. The third course was started April 7, but its week was interrupted by the period of Passover, when all priests officiated together, and this caused the third course not to end its administration until the Sabbath after Passover on April 21. Then the weekly courses started again in their regular order of service. Now we come to the eighth course of Abijah. The period for the eighth course of Abijah that Zechariah was involved in would have been from May 19 to May 26. If it were in this springtime administration, when the angelic messenger came to Zechariah about his wife having a child, then we have a chronological hint of the period for John the Baptist's conception, because it must have happened immediately after that period. Indeed, because Zechariah was struck dumb and silent during his administration, he was immediately disqualified at once from exercising the priest's office. This is according to Leviticus 21, verses 16 to 23. He no doubt left very soon for home, in which case he probably was motivated to do what the angel suggested. Thus, somewhere near May 26 to June 1st, Elizabeth must have conceived. The human gestation period is about 280 days, which is 9 months and 10 days, give or take. This shows the birth of John the Baptist would occur about March 10, 3 BC. Now let's look at the birth of Jesus. From what we have observed at about the approximate time of John's birth, it would be easy to compute that of Jesus. Luke said that Jesus was conceived sometime during the sixth month of Elizabeth's pregnancy. This is comparing Luke 1, verse 26, with verse 36. Luke chapter 1, 26 and 36, comparing them together. 5 full months had passed, and Elizabeth was then in her sixth month. Since John the Baptist was probably born sometime around March 10, 3 BC, Jesus' birth would have been near September in 3 BC. And we will soon see from other astronomical data that this is the only year that will satisfy all of the facts. And it must be admitted that it is impossible to arrive at an exact birthday for either John the Baptist or Jesus based alone solely on the priestly courses. Yet the information provided by Luke helps us pick the approximate periods with some confidence. 2 or 3 weeks either way would be the outside limit. There is, however, a possibility that Luke was referring to Zechariah's late autumn session in the temple instead of the springtime session. If so, we would have a six-month displacement for the time of John and Jesus' births. John would have been born near the middle of September, and Jesus would have been born early the following March. Yet there are reasons for not accepting this. Luke said that Jesus was born at a time when his parents went to Bethlehem in response to Caesar's command for a census. Professor Ramsey showed that considerable confidence can be placed in the belief that the general time of the year for the start of a census was from August to October. And once again, this is William F. Ramsey's book, Born at Bethlehem, page 193. The September period for Jesus' birth, we are suggesting, fits this very well. And there are other reasons. A late summer or early autumn date for Jesus' birth has also been suggested because Luke said that the shepherds were tending their flocks at night at the time of his nativity. Luke 2, verse 8. And many have believed that this precludes a wintertime birth, either early winter on December 25th or a late winter in early March, because it would have been too cold for the flocks to be out in the open at that time. But this evidence is problematic. In exceptionally cold winters, this may have been the case, but in mild winters, sheep are often kept out of doors in Palestine all night. Since no one knows what kind of weather there was in Palestine the year of Jesus' birth, either severe or mild, this factor can be of no chronological value. Now, some have thought that Jesus was born at the period of the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles, because John in his Gospel said that Jesus, quote, tabernacled among us, and this is in the Greek of John chapter 1, verse 14. Tabernacled among us. Tabernacles is in the year 3 BC, which was from September 26 to October 3rd, September 26 to October 3rd in 3 BC. But Jesus' birth at this time was not possible. Actually, there is clear proof that Jesus' birth could not have been at any of the three holy periods of Passover, Pentecost, or Tabernacles. These were times when all Jewish men were required by biblical law to be in Jerusalem. And this was according to Deuteronomy chapter 16, verses 6, 11, and 16. Yet Luke tells us that during the time of Jesus' nativity, everyone went into his own city, end quote. Luke 2, verse 3. Besides, the Romans would not have selected the three primary festival seasons for a census, when most of the Jews in Palestine were required to be in Jerusalem. The reason that there was no room at the inn was not because the people were crowding into the Jerusalem area for ceremonial purposes, but as Luke tells us, they were there to be registered for the census. Also, since our new history shows that the census and the oath of allegiance to Augustus for his award, for Augustus' award of the pater patriae, were one and the same, it then makes sense that even Mary, who was in biblical law able to bear a king of the Jews, would also be expected to swear that she and her offspring would remain loyal to the existing government. And this census no doubt occurred in the latter part of 3 BC, as Dr. Martin will later show in detail, and not in the late winter or early spring of 3 BC. Now, there is another reason for placing Jesus' birth in September, and it's a powerful one. This is because the New Testament itself gives a precise chronological sign that identifies the exact day that Jesus was born. And in fact, within a period of an hour and a half on that day. And it's now time to look at this New Testament indication. The exact date can be picked of Jesus' birth. There are only three places in the New Testament that record any events connected with the birth of Christ. These are in Matthew's Gospel, Luke's Gospel, and chapter 12 of the book of Revelation. This latter book has some information about Jesus' birth that should be considered, though it must be admitted that all data in the book of Revelation are highly symbolic. And yet the figurative nature of the book may contain the very clue we need to precisely date the birth of Jesus. Now, people in the first century were very prone to use astronomical signs as having bearing on historical and religious events. They were especially important regarding the births of eminent people and the kings in particular. But, of course, this meant nothing in the Bible. The Bible only talks about, you know, Jesus and the plan of salvation written in the stars. And, of course, Jesus is central to them. Now, because of this, the section about Jesus' birth in the book of Revelation may have been significantly related to particular heavenly signs that Jesus had formerly told his disciples to be aware of in Luke 21, verse 11. Now, let us look at Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 to 5. This gives us precise indications as to the hour and the day that Jesus was born, and this section should be read carefully. Quote, "And there was a great wonder, or a sign, in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth and pained to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder, another sign in the heavens. And behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 7 horns and 7 crowns on his head. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child who was to rule all the nations with a rod of iron." End quote, Revelation 12, verses 1 to 5. The scene just described is symbolic. Certainly, this could hardly be a description of the Virgin Mary. This woman had the heavens associated with her, the sun and the moon and the 12 stars. John said that the display was a wonder or a sign that took place in heaven. Now, what did John mean by the phrase, in heaven? Well, the Bible speaks of three heavens. The first is the heaven in which the birds fly and all the weather phenomena occur. This is mentioned in Jeremiah 4, verse 25, and 1 Kings 18, verse 45. The second is that of the sun, the moon, and the planets and the stars. This is mentioned in Genesis, indicated in Genesis chapter 1, verse 17. The third heaven is that where God lives, 2 Corinthians 12, verse 2. Now, which of these heavens is meant? People of the first century would have had no difficulty in interpreting the proper heaven that was intended by the Apostle John. The sun, moon, and stars are not located in our atmosphere where the birds and the clouds exist. They are also not found in the heaven where God has his abode, because John tells us specifically that the sun or moon are not needed in the region where God is, according to Revelation chapter 21, verse 23. Therefore, the only heaven that is reasonable is that where the sun, moon, and the 12 stars are located. The book of Genesis revealed that the celestial bodies were made by God to give signs to mankind. This is in Genesis 1, verse 14. And not just to mankind, but to everyone and everything from the perspective of the earth. Jewish opinion included among these signs the astronomical associations between the sun, the moon, the planets, the stars, and the constellations. And this is written about in a Jewish philosopher in Alexandria by the name of Philo, and also the Jewish commentator Rashi. Now, there can be hardly any doubt that such astronomical signs as these are referred to in the book of Revelation. With these points in mind, we may have some interesting clues that provide us, and indeed they do, with the exact time of Jesus' birth. The essential factor in interpreting the symbol of Revelation 12, verses 1 to 5, is the identification of the woman. What is John signifying by mentioning her? Well, this much is certain. The woman in the first three verses is featured as being in heaven, and both the sun and the moon are in association with her. After the dragon cast down a third of the stars of heaven, Revelation 12, verse 4, the woman is then found on earth, verses 6 and 14. But the important factor is the birth of the man-child and the woman's relationship with the heavenly signs while she is symbolically in heaven. The first three verses of Revelation chapter 12 show the sun clothing her, the moon under her feet, and the 12 stars on her head. The birth of the Messiah is associated with this heavenly spectacle. Some have noted heavenly bodies are a part of the picture. It could well be that John intended the woman to represent a constellation that the two primary luminaries, the sun and the moon, traverse, and that she was part of the zodiacal system that gives headship to the signs. The 12 stars would have been a crown upon her head. Recall that interpreting astronomical signs dominated the thinking of most people in the first century, whether they were Jews or Gentiles. And indeed, the word sign used by the author of Revelation to describe this celestial display was the same word used by the ancients, the Greeks, to denote the zodiacal constellations. And this is in Little and Scott's lexicon. Now, this is made clearer when one looks closely at the text. Since the sun and moon are amidst or in line with the body of this woman, she could be, in a symbolic way, a constellation located within the normal paths of the sun and the moon. The only sign of a woman that exists along the ecliptic, the track of the sun and its journey through the stars, is that of Virgo the Virgin. She occupies in body form, symbolic body form, a space of about 50 degrees along the ecliptic. The head of the woman actually bridges some 10 degrees into the previous sign of Leo, and her feet overlap about 10 degrees into the following sign of Libra, the scales. in the period of Jesus' birth, the sun entered its annual course through the heavens into the head position of the woman about August 13, and it exited from her feet about October 2nd. But the Apostle John saw the scene when the sun was clothing or adorning the woman. This surely indicates that the position of the sun in the vision was located somewhere mid-bodied to the woman, between the neck and the knees. The sun could hardly be said to clothe her if it were situated in her face or near her feet. The only time of the year when the sun would be in position to clothe the celestial woman called Virgo, that is to be mid-bodied to her, in the region where a pregnant woman carries a child, is when the sun is located between 150 and 170 degrees along the ecliptic. This clothing of the woman by the sun occurs for a 20-day period each year. This 20-degree spread would indicate the general time when Jesus was born. In 3 BC, the sun would have entered this celestial region from about August 27th and exited from it about September 15th. If John in the book of Revelation is associating the birth of Jesus with the period when the sun was mid-bodied to this woman called Virgo, and this is no doubt what he means, then Jesus would have been born within that 20-day period. From the point of view of the Magi, who were astrologers, this would have been the only logical sign under which the Jewish Messiah might be born, especially if he was to be born of a virgin. Even today, astrologers recognize the sign of Virgo is the one which has reference to a messianic world ruler to be born from a virgin. This is from Devor's Encyclopedia of Astrology, page 366. This heavenly woman called Virgo is normally depicted as a virgin holding her right hand, in her right hand a green branch, and in her left hand a sprig of grain. In the Hebrew zodiac, she at first, in the time of David, denoted Ruth, who was gleaning in the fields of Boaz. She then later became the virgin when the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, was given in the time of Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah. This virgin held in her left hand a sprig of grain, and this was precisely where the bright star called Spica is found. Indeed, the chief star of the constellation Virgo is Spica. Bullinger, in his book Witness of the Stars, pages 29 to 34, and that entire book is available on the Internet, not on the ASK website, but is available on the Internet. Witness of the Stars in Bullinger said that the word Spica has, through the Arabic, the meaning of, quote, the branch, end quote, and it symbolically refers to Jesus, who was prophetically called the branch in Zechariah 3, verse 8 and 6, verse 12. And Bullinger and Professor Sace, in his book, The Gospel in the Stars, both correctly maintain that this sign of Virgo designates the heavenly witness for the birth of the Messiah, Jesus. They say that Virgo should actually begin the zodiacal signs which give the story of the Messiah, and that then the rest of the signs actually tell the story of the Messiah and the plan of God's salvation. And this may be the case. Although the names have been lost, so we must depend on Scripture for the message of salvation and no longer depend on any information from the stars. The Apostle John, however, may have given the same indications as far as the first full sign of the zodiac is concerned. He depicted the woman of Revelation as having a crown of 12 stars on her head. Now, this could well show that the woman, Virgo, is the constellation of headship for all the 12 signs, in other words, the beginning sign, through which all the others then progress. The head sign of Virgo is located within the last 10 degrees of Leo. This was in the It was in this very region where the story of the career of the Messiah would begin that Bullinger and Seiss, Professor Seiss, referred to. Thus, the story of Jesus and his mission on earth, as related by these heavenly symbols, would logically begin with his birth from a virgin and conclude with him being crowned king in the final sign of Leo the Lion, with its chief star being Regulus, the star Regulus, which is the king star, as we've covered earlier. There is no doubt that the Apostle John was trying to show through the symbols, or what the Apostle John was trying to show through the symbols found in Revelation chapter 12. And then there's a diagram online, on the book online in this chapter, showing the various positions at various days and times, particularly the times, during a particular of each day, where the position of the moon would be and the sun during this period of time. The birth of this child in Revelation chapter 12, whom John identified with Jesus, should have occurred while the sun was clothing the woman, when the sun was mid-body to Virgo. And as we said before, this period in time in 3 BC covered 20 days, from August 27 to September 15. If Jesus were born within that 20-day period, it would fit most remarkably with the testimony of Luke, relative to the birth of John the Baptist and the eighth course of Abijah. Indeed, the chronological indications associated with the priestly course of Abijah placed Jesus' birth exactly within this period. But there is a way to arrive at an even much closer time for Jesus' birth than a simple 20-day period. The position of the moon in John's vision actually pinpoints the nativity to within a day and even to within a period of an hour and a half, 90 minutes, on that day. Now, this may appear to be an absurd assessment on the surface, but it is quite possible. The key is the moon. The apostle specifically said it was located, quote, under her feet, end quote. Well, what does the word under signify in this case? Does it mean the woman of the vision was standing on the moon when John observed it? Or does it mean her feet were positioned slightly above the moon? Well, John does not tell us. This, however, is not of major consequence in using the location of the moon to answer our question, because it would only involve the difference of a degree or two. The moon travels about 12 degrees a day in its course through the heavens. The motion of 1 or 2 degrees by the moon represents, on Earth, a period of 2 to 4 hours. The difference is no problem in determining the time of Christ's birth. What is vital, however, is that this shows that the moon was a new moon. The precise position of the moon is important. Now note this point. Since the feet of Virgo the Virgin represented the last 7 degrees of the constellation, in the time of Jesus, this would have been about 180 to 187 degrees along the ecliptic. The moon has to be positioned somewhere under that 7-degree arc to satisfy the description of Revelation chapter 12. But the moon also has to be in that position, in that exact location, when the sun is mid-body to Virgo. In the year 3 BC, these two factors came to precise agreement for about an hour and a half, as observed from Palestine or from Patmos in the twilight period on September 11. The relationship began about 6:15 p.m. at sunset and lasted until around 7:45 p.m. moonset. This is the only day of the whole year that the astronomical phenomenon described in the 12th chapter of Revelation could take place. This would mean that the Revelation chapter 12, verse 1 to 5, is like a time stamp that you would make a seal with and make a time stamp, like when you do a time card in a factory. And it would precisely date the time when Christ was born. The moon was in its crescent phase. This was a new moon day, the start of a new lunar month. And Dr. Martin then shows that there were many depictions, as you will see, all over the older Christian churches and cathedrals throughout the world and in art, where the Virgin Mary is holding the child, mid-bodied, encompassed by the sun, with 12 stars around her head, and the moon, a crescent moon, under her feet. And there's two plates of showing this from Dr. Martin's book on the website and in the printed book. And modern man and astronomical motions, we'll need to discuss that now. While ordinary people in modern times who are not professional astronomers have actually very little knowledge of the solar, lunar, planetary, and stellar motions, the people of the first century up to the Industrial Revolution were well acquainted to them. Even people of little education were generally knowledgeable about the main motions of the astronomical bodies, even more than most college-educated people today. When anyone in early times read Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, an astronomical relationship was realized at once. There was no doubt that a new moon display was being shown to them. And when the woman of the sign was interpreted as Virgo the Virgin, and with the sun mid-body to the Virgin, they clearly saw a new moon occurring sometime in late summer. The Apostle John said that this heavenly relationship occurred at the time of Jesus' birth. And in 3 BC, this exact combination of celestial factors happened just after sunset on only one day of the year. It was September 11th. It could not have occurred at any other time of the year, September 11th, 3 BC. Indeed, even one day before, on September 10th, the moon would have been located above the Virgin's feet, not under, with the crescent not visible. One day farther, on September 12th, the moon would have moved too far beyond the feet of the Virgin, at least 25 diameters of the moon east of her feet. Only one day applies, and that day was after sunset, on September 11th, 3 B.C. So, for the exact day of Jesus' birth, the Apostle John is presenting to his readers something of a profound significance in a symbolic way. Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, shows a new moon day that could only be observed from Earth just after sunset, and the day was September 11th. This fits well with Luke's description of the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem. Recall that, quote, Luke 2, verses 8 to 11, quote, there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over the flock by night. And the angel said, unto you is born this day, which began at sundown, in the city of David, a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. Luke 2, verses 8 to 11. Now, Jesus was born in the early evening, according to Luke 2, and Revelation shows that it was a new moon day. What new moon could this have been? Well, the answer is most amazing. This is almost too amazing, Dr. Martin says. September 11, 3 B.C., was Tishri 1, on the Jewish calendar. To Jewish people, this would have been a very profound occasion indeed. Tishri 1 was none other than the Jewish New Year's Day, called Rosh Hashanah, as the Bible calls it, the Day of Trumpets, in Leviticus 23, verses 23 to 26. It was an important annual holy day of the Jews, but not one of the three annual festivals that required all Palestinian Jews to be in Jerusalem. However, most Jews came for all the fall festival periods, so they came early to observe the Day of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, as well as the Feast of Tabernacles. What a significant day for the appearance of the Messiah to arrive on earth from the Jewish point of view and remark on New Year's Day. And remarkably, no other day of the year could astronomically fit Revelation 12, verses 1 to 3. The Apostle John is certainly showing forth an astronomical sign, or as I say, a time state, a time stamp, which answers precisely with the Jewish New Year Day. John would have realized the significance of this astronomical scene that he was describing. In the next chapter, I will show, Dr. Martin says, the symbolic and religious meaning of this New Year's Day as interpreted by the Jews and consequently by the apostles and the early Christians as it relates to the Messiah and his kingship. The information may provide a better understanding why the early apostles of the first century and many Jews and Gentiles so quickly came to accept Jesus as the Messiah. Whatever the case, as the historical evidence supports the nativity of Jesus in 3 BC at the beginning of the Roman census, and if we use the astronomical indications in the book of Revelation, his birth would have occurred just after sundown on September 11th on Rosh Hashanah, the Day of Trumpets, the Jewish New Year for governmental affairs. There could hardly have been a better day for in the ecclesiastical calendar of the affairs of the Jews. Let me do that sentence over. There could hardly have been a better day in the ecclesiastical calendar of the Jews to introduce the Messiah to the world from a Jewish point of view. And no doubt this is what the Apostle John clearly intended to show by the sign he recorded in Revelation chapter 12. And so ends chapter 5, the time of Jesus' birth, for the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. Next time we'll deal with chapter 6. So thank you, Georgianne, and this concludes this session of the Byte Show regarding chapter 5 of the Star of Bethlehem. So goodbye, everybody. Take care.